Yeah, I'm going to put out a shout out for my primo Sleepy in Reno, Nevada, my homie Gordo and the homie Scam. Stay up, you know, and, you know, stay good. And I want to throw down one of the George King.
All right.
Which one? Anyone you want to throw down of George King.
Okay, we'll do that for you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to us in Phoenix on 104.3 and
99.3. Yeah, stay up.
This is a story of famous dog. For the dog that chases its tail will be busy. These are clapping dogs, rhythmic dogs, harmonic dogs, house dogs, street dogs, dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, counting dog, funky dog. Nasty dog.
Hey everybody, we know who that is. That's George Clinton in the background. And it's 6 p.m. and I haven't been here in a couple months. This is Hassan and I'm doing the 6 p.m. news. And I want to thank Curtis for doing it for the past month or two. Curtis is now doing the IMC show every Wednesday from 4 to 6. And so again, thanks Curtis for covering the news these past couple weeks. And I will be doing every other Friday now with Johnny Radio. He's going to be doing the news on one Friday, and then he'll be and then I'll be doing it the other. So he'll be on next Friday at 6 p.m. But anyway, it's good to be back in the news anchor seat here at KillRadio.org. I love Kill Radio, and this is George Clinton in the background. Oh, hey, if you guys out there who are P-Funkers, who are George Clinton fans, you know I interviewed the brother. He was in town with Flea and the Chili Peppers last month. Of the Greek Theater here in Los Angeles. And we got a great interview with him, and you can hear it at radioforall.net. Radio number 4 all.net. Just go there and type in George Clinton, and you'll hear the interview that moi did with him. Hassan, myself, me. I also do the jazz show on Monday night at midnight, every Monday at midnight. I will be here this Monday. Haven't been here in a while, but I will be here this Monday. Hopefully my co-host Vanessa will be with me. Oh, and we got Waco coming in the next couple weeks on Straight Ahead, my Monday Night Jazz show. Waco, the East Side Los Angeles Chamber Music Company. Steve Gregoropoulos, and he'll be telling about a symphony he's getting ready to do. So anyway, this is George Clinton in the background here on the 6 p.m. Kill Radio News. You know, we got a new board here, so please excuse me. I'm kind of getting used to it. You know, we have no engineer here at Kill Radio. Well, we have one, but a lot of times he's too busy with other things. There's a lot to do here at Kill Radio. So we're just happy with him when he can give us some time. But I'm still learning this new board, so there might be some bloopers today. But I have some good stuff. I'm going to read an article from the LA Times about this woman who was fired from the Pentagon. She was a contractor, and she was an honest contractor. And she just didn't like seeing Halliburton getting like fat. And she said no more, and they fired her. You know, she had been with the Pentagon as a contractor for almost 20 years. I'm going to read the article. And this is a pretty old article. I've had it for a while because I haven't been here in a while. It's from the LA Times, August 30th, 2005. It's a great article, though. they just don't want honest people working, you know, near the Bush cabinet or anything like that. Oh, and check this out, everybody. I had two things I wanted to talk about. I rode the Orange Line today. For those of you who are not here in Los Angeles, the Orange Line, I want to talk about that for a second. The Orange Line is a new busway we have here in Los Angeles. Turn George Clinton down a little more. We have this new Orange Line. LA is getting trains back. You know, LA had one of the top rail. LA was one of the top light rail cities in the country in the 40s, and then everybody knows what happened. The cars came and got rid of the trains, and the city air got polluted out here. And now trains are back in Los Angeles. Our Blue Line here, they say, is one of the most highly traveled inner city light rail project in the country. And I take the subway to work every day. I park my car and I take the subway. It gets me there like 20 times faster. I take 200 miles a week off my car. And I love riding in the subway because I did not grow up in New York, and I just love being in the subway. All my New York friends make fun of me because I'm like a little kid in the subway here in Los Angeles. Yeah, we have a subway in Los Angeles, everybody. But anyway, they opened up this new thing out here today, 2 days ago, called the Orange Line. Okay, and it's a dedicated busway from downtown Los Angeles all the way to this place called Warner Center, way out in the San Fernando Valley. Everybody's heard of the San Fernando Valley, Los Angeles, you know, the Valley Girl thing. So I wrote it today because actually it wouldn't work for me, but I just wrote it today anyway to see what it was like, and it's kind of out of my way. And it's a great ride. You know, like I said, it opened 3 days ago in New York. They've been having a lot of problems with it. There's been 2 major accidents. Luckily, no one was killed. And I just read in the LA Times this morning that the prototype for the LA Orange Line was this road dedicated busway in Miami. And they just admitted this morning, I don't know whether the LA Times did not report it or the MTA just admitted it, but this bus project in Miami was a prototype. And when they opened theirs like 7 or 8 years ago, there were 42 accidents and 2 deaths. So far, knock on wood, there's been no deaths here in Los Angeles, but there's been 2 pretty bad accidents on the Orange Line. But it gets people out of their cars, and I heard a lot of people were riding it. You know, so that's good, because the air in Los Angeles has gotten like a lot better in the 30 years I've been out here. Oh, and something else, well, I wanted to talk about that, and I said that. So here in Los Angeles, take a ride on the Orange Line. It takes you right to our subway. You can get all your cars, you know. Something else I wanted to talk about, I was riding around in my new car today. I got a new car, well, it's a new used car, listening to the radio here in Los Angeles. After I got off the Orange Line, I got to my car. And I heard the Bush is tanking. President Bush is tanking in the polls. He's like, what, 30-35% now? And I just noticed his smile went across my face. So that basically means, what, 60% of the country can't stand him? You know, unfortunately, that the military is not in that 60%. Our military is like 90% Republican, which is, some senators are worried about that because you have an option for a coup there. You know, but anyway, Bush's approval is like 37% right now, and it's still going deeper. You know, his boys are going to jail. Scooter Libby, who I hear we're going to be doing a phone interview here on Webhead Theater this Sunday night with Scooter Libby, so tune in for that on Webhead Theater, David Raquel's Webhead Theater. But anyway, yeah, wow, we're interviewing Scooter Libby on Kill Radio. But anyway, Bush is tanking at the polls. So, again, welcome to the 6 p.m. Kill Radio. Oh, I'm sorry, guys, I didn't know this board was this hot. Like I've said, I haven't been around in a while. Oh, wow, that was pretty hot. So anyway, this is Hassan. This is the 6 p.m. Friday News. That was George Clinton. And let's see, you know, I'm going to go into a little John Coltrane, and then we're going to go into this article about this contractor who was fired by the Pentagon. So excuse me if there's some bloopers, because like I said, I'm trying to get used to this new board here. Oh, now I got to keep talking because I can't get this computer. Okay, I hear John Coltrane coming on. This is the 6 p.m. Kill Radio News. So we're going to listen to a little Coltrane, and then we're going to go into this LA, great LA Times article. Okay, hold on, everybody. Wait a minute. You You know, I'm sorry that I'm really off today. That's Oliver Nelson and Eric Dolphy. Yeah. Which is just as good as John Coltrane. In my humble opinion. But I still love John Coltrane. Again, that's a bad habit of me. I'm not a professional newsman, and I don't want to try and pretend to be. But I'll play some music to lead into a story like this LA Times story, and the music will sound so good I won't want to take it off. But they keep telling me, they say, Hassan, when you're doing that, just play a little bit of music, not a lot. So anyway, let's see. Okay, how can I get this microphone so I can read this? Testing, testing. Is everyone here? Are you guys all out here ready, listening? Okay, let me put Coltrane on pause here in the background. No, not us, Eric Dolphy, yeah. Okay, this is, and today is Friday. Today's date is Friday, November 11th, what, a week after Halloween, 2005? And this article from the LA Times, Tuesday, August 30th, 2005. Los Angeles Times. It's written by a gentleman. LA Times is getting some really great writers. It's by a gentleman named T. Christian Miller, Times staff writer. The title of this article is "Democrats Demand Probe of Demolition." I'm sorry, "Democrats Demand Probe of Demotion." Take this mic out of the holder here. Okay. Now I feel a little better. See, a corp, then I got a byline here. A corps of engineers officials had called Halliburton's no-bid contract blatant and improper during congressional testimonies by Time staff writer T. Christian Miller. Washington. Congressional Democrats demanded an investigation Monday into the demotion of a senior U.S. military contracting official who publicly criticized a controversial no-bid contract awarded to Halliburton Corp. for work in Iraq. With more than 20 years' experience in government procurement, Bunatine Greenhouse had been the Army Corps of Engineers' top contracting officer until she was demoted Saturday to a lower-level position. A military report indicated that she was demoted for poor job performance. Greenhouse had repeatedly challenged the Corps' commanding officers on their decision in 2003 to give a contract worth up to $7 billion to repair oil infrastructure to Halliburton, the Houston-based oil services company once run by Vice President Dick Cheney. They went after her to destroy her, said Michael Cohn, her attorney, who added that the demotion was absolutely in retaliation for her complaints about the Halliburton contract. Democrats who had invited Greenhouse to testify about her concerns at a June hearing asked Defense Secretary Donald H. Rumsfeld in a letter Monday to investigate and to restate her in the meantime. At that June hearing, Greenhouse called the Halliburton case the most, quote unquote, the most blatant and improper contract abuse I have witnessed during the course of my professional career, quote unquote. 3 weeks later, the Secretary of the Army approves. Let me open this paper up. Hold on. Bear with me, folks. Let me see. 3 weeks later, the Secretary of the Army approved the Corps of Engineers' decision to demote her. It took effect over the weekend. Retaliation against employees for providing information to Congress is illegal and entirely unacceptable, said the letter, which was signed by Representative Henry A. Waxman, a Democrat from Los Angeles, Senators Byron L. Dorgan. I hear rap music in the background. What's going on here? Senators Byron R.L. Dorgan, Democrat from New York. Hold on. I think I know what's going on here. Wait a minute. Okay. Anyway, like I said, there's no engineer here at Lock Kill Radio. Democrat from Los Angeles, Senator Byron L. Dorgan, Democrat. And Frank R. Lindenberg, Democrat from New Jersey. Ms. Greenhouse has given Congress important information essential to our oversight of waste, fraud, and abuse, quote unquote. Greenhouse also angered insurance companies with a proposal intended to save hundreds of millions of dollars by offering cheaper workers' compensation style insurance to federal contractors. Her initiative drew sharp resistance. Her initiative drew sharp resistance from some of the country's most powerful insurance companies, which could lose business under the proposal. The Corps was scheduled to make an announcement on the cost-saving program as early as September. It was unclear Monday whether Greenhouse's demotion would affect the program, which would have awarded the insurance to a single carrier through competitive bidding. This was her baby. She's the one who fought for this thing, and she made some people upset, said one insurance industry official who has monitored the program. The Army general who hired Greenhouse, who was black, said her race and sex also played a role in her demotion. Known for her insistence on following rules, she clashed repeatedly with a mostly white old boy network at the Corps of Engineers, according to Lieutenant General Joe Ballard. Greenhouse's race and gender ruffled a lot of feathers in the Corps' command and also contributed to the desperate and highly critical treatment she has received, Ballard wrote as part of a deposition given during an internal process to appeal her demotion. Ballard, who was also black, said he had received similar treatment even as a commander. Both the Corps and the Department of the Army declined comment, citing privacy restrictions surrounding personal issues, but a Corps of Engineers report provided by Cohn showed that top officials criticized Greenhouse for not being a team player. The report said Greenhouse's poor performance ratings were due to Ms. Greenhouse's insistence on restricting her role as a Corps senior contracting official to merely passing judgment on matters presented to her, instead of personally engaging in a collaborative process with other Corps leaders. Greenhouse had also been criticized for writing notes by hand on official Corps contracting documents, according to the report. Greenhouse's demotion is the latest twist in a drama that began more than 2 years ago when she raised concerns about giving Halliburton subsidiary KBR the oil contract in Iraq for 5 years. Oh, she was the one that did that? She thought that the contract should have been given. She thought that the contract should have been for a shorter period to allow competitive bidding to take place sooner. In December 2003, she accused the Corps of deliberately bypassing her to excuse Halliburton from having to provide auditors with cost data to justify the price it had just paid to import fuel into Iraq. In the summer of 2004, she opposed the Corps of Engineers' efforts to extend a Halliburton contract to feed and house U.S. troops in the Balkans, arguing that it should have been competitively awarded. Go, girl. In October 2004, Lieutenant General Carl Stroke, the Corps commander, attempted to demote Greenhouse, citing a history of negative performance reviews. Instead, she went public, and her complaints became an election year controversy because of Cheney's ties to Halliburton. In response, the Army promised to have the Pentagon Inspector General investigate Greenhouse's complaints of abuse and directed Strzok to suspend any adverse personnel action so that Ms. Greenhouse remains in her current position until a sufficient record is available to address the specific matter, quote-unquote, raised by her case. In June, Strzok sent a memo with an unsigned 9-page report rebutting Greenhouse's accusations to the Army Inspector General. Strzok said the report showed that Greenhouse's demotion, quote-unquote, is based on her performance and not in retaliation for any disclosures of alleged improprieties she may have made, quote-unquote. Among her defenses, the report noted that the Government Accountability Office had concluded that the oil contract had been properly awarded. The report found problems elsewhere in the decision-making. This is the last paragraph here, so get your ears next to the speaker. The Pentagon Inspector General's investigation into Greenhouse's accusations is continuing, and investigators are working with the Department of Justice on potential prosecutions, quote-unquote, according to the letter from the Congressional Democrats. Cohn said the Inspector General also had promised to investigate whether Greenhouse's demotion was an illegal retaliation act, whether Greenhouse's demotion was an illegal retaliatory action. The Pentagon Inspector General did not return repeated calls for comment. End of article. And again, this is a great article by a writer here at the LA, in Los Angeles at the LA Times by T. Craig Christian Miller. So email him and tell him that you heard me reading his article on Kill Radio. You can just, I'm sure, go to the LA Times website. And, okay, and that was from the LA Times, Tuesday, August 30th, 2005. And again, this is the 6 p.m. Friday Kill Radio News. Oh, beautiful day here in Los Angeles. I love it. I love winter in LA. I love it. I hate summer out here. I wish it could be winter all year round in Los Angeles. We're coming up on a beautiful Thanksgiving in a couple weeks. Bush's poll numbers are tanking. And let's go back to Eric Dolphy and Oliver Nelson. Okay, and this is Kill Radio. I'm sorry. There I go again, playing too much music. I just love Oliver Nelson and Eric Dolphy. Are you guys with me out there? Are you out there? Killradio.org. What I'm going to do now, I'm going to try and get it queued up. We're going to go back into a little more music, but I'm going to be queuing up this great interview that I stole off of a local left-wing radio station about the state of black primary education in this country. I'm sorry. Ooh, I'm screaming. The article I just read in the LA Times, in case I didn't tell you guys, that the woman in question was an African-American lady who was the contractor. But anyway, what we're going to hear right now, this interview that I blatantly stole from a local LA radio station about the state of education in this country and how kids in the inner city, how their elementary schools are the last to be given money and everything, which is really fucked up. You know, excuse my French. I'm going to cue that up in a minute, but let's go back to some jazz here at the 6 p.m. Kill Radio News. Listening to Eric Dolphy in the background getting ready for this great article on the state of education in the country, our own DJ Johnny Radio, who I said will be taking turns with me on the news, he's going to read a little breaking news story here in Los Angeles about a great institution that's getting ready to be torn down. They don't save cultural things here in Los Angeles. You ready, John? Okay, and maybe John will say hi to everybody. He's going to be doing the news next week. We're going to be switching off, and you'll get to meet him. He has a show here. He can tell you about his other show, and he's going to do it all in 5 seconds. No. Johnny's going to be switching off every other Friday with me. Here you go, Johnny.
Thank you, Hassan. I'm going to be doing the news, and as Hassan said, so I'm looking forward to doing that. I wanted to make a little announcement about an event happening tonight at the Brown Derby. If you're not familiar with the Brown Derby, please go to savetheDerby.com. This is a reminder that a band called the Royal Crown Review returns to the world-famous Derby tonight, November 4th, for what is turning out to be a very special event. Subway to Venus will be on the bill. If you haven't heard about this multi-talented ska-funk ensemble, you must do so post-haste. Peter Loggins will be in the house, renowned dancer, teacher, and historian. The Save the Derby is famous for swing dancing. Peter Loggins is going to come and reveal some moves that will make your eyeballs pop. Finally, if you are interested in the campaign to save the Derby, the wonderful grassroots organization which has dedicated itself to doing just that will be at the show in force. Bringing gorgeous photos of the Derby going back to the 1920s when it was first built and later owned by Cecil B. DeMille.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's right.
Wow.
And the Derby is being threatened with demolition to put in some high-priced condos.
For our out-of-state audiences, the Derby's here in Los Angeles.
That's correct. That's Los Angeles at the corner of Los Feliz Boulevard and Hillhurst.
Near Hollywood.
Near Hollywood. Thank you, Hassan, and thanks for that moment, and here's Hassan back.
When can we hear you? When, what are you doing?
Well, my regular show is Fridays noon to 2, except today I was not able to broadcast due to some non-technical difficulties. Okay,
and that was the voice of Johnny Radio, who's new on board here at the station. He's been here a couple months, and he has a regular show on Fridays at 2, and he's going to be doing the news twice a month here at 6 on Friday. Thanks, Johnny. So support the Derby. I've ate there before. They have great food. And let's go back into Eric Dahlfield. Where are my glasses? Lost my glasses. Wait a minute.
Unfortunately, the truth is just the opposite. He writes that schools already deeply segregated 25 or 30 years ago are no less segregated now, and thousands of other schools that had been integrated have since been rapidly resegregating. The facts will blow off your socks, or maybe not. The question is what to do about it. Jonathan Kozel's with us on the line, joining us from Boston, I believe. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Laura. And I must say it's just amazing that segregation has returned with such a sweeping vengeance in the past 15 years. It's now back to the point where it stood in 1968 when Dr. King died.
Incredible stuff. I mean, we started the program talking about or hearing Pat Buchanan complaining about the revolution he's been fighting for 40 years and how disappointed he is with the president's pick for the Supreme Court because, heck, the president might not be advancing this retreat, if you will, in the way that Buchanan might like. You write about how the gains we thought we'd made as a nation have not been made either, Republican, right-wing backlash or not. Tell us what you found.
Well, I've just spent the past 5 years visiting about 60 schools across the country, and I simply never see white children in the inner-city schools. If you looked at a photograph of the typical classroom that I visit, it looks exactly like the old photos we have from Mississippi in the 1940s. Four most segregated states in America, interestingly enough, are all in the North or in the West. New York is the most segregated and unequal state for black and Latino kids. Michigan second, Illinois third, and then California. And, you know, the great irony for me is that, and black people joke about this all the time, a kind of bitter joke, if you want to see a really segregated school in the United States today, just ask for a school that's named for Dr. King, for Martin Luther King, or maybe for Thurgood Marshall or Rosa Parks. I always, you know, and a few of these are good schools, but usually they're not. Usually these are the worst, most overcrowded, poorly funded schools in every city that I visit, with the worst outcomes in terms of awful dropout rates. And they're usually smelly, ugly schools. You know, I go into them. My book isn't written from a think tank. I spent 5 years just, you know, tramping the corridors of these schools. And, you know, if you really want to know what we're doing to children in these schools, you've got to do that. You've got to go with them into the vile basement cafeterias where they're herded along for squalid feedings in ugly rooms where no business CEO would be willing to spend 1 hour. I always make it a point of going to the bathrooms in these schools and not the teacher's bathroom. I want to smell what children smell and feel what they feel. And, you know, when I go to a school that's named for Dr. King or Thurgood Marshall, and, you know, it's completely segregated, and I don't mean just kind of segregated, I mean where there might be 4,000 black and Latino kids and not one white child in the building, and where there's this air of, you know, deep despondency because the kids know what's being done to them, I always wonder why we name these schools for people that black folks love. I always wonder why. I always think we ought to name them for people they don't like.
Well, maybe the idea.
Name,
name should be enough.
Yeah, I think we should name these horrible schools, you know, for people black folks really hate, like, call it William Bennett Academy of Personal Morality, or Clarence Thomas Academy of Self-Help and Self-Hate.
So what happened to Brown v. Board?
Well, basically, Brown versus Board of Education was a spectacular success for several decades up until the late 1980s. During that time, tens of thousands of schools in the United States were integrated with tremendous success. And during that time, interestingly and not coincidentally, the gap in learning skills between black and Latino kids on the one hand and white kids on the other narrowed dramatically. Most important, blacks were catching up. Since 1990, the Rehnquist Court has basically ripped apart Brown versus Board of Education. It's dismantled all of its enforcement instruments. So now we see schools which are right back where they were the year that Dr. King died, if not more segregated. And, interestingly enough, and sadly enough, the racial gap has widened once again. So now, at this particular moment, after all President Bush's claims about the great success of his testing agenda and so forth, the average black 12th grader in America reads and writes at the level of the average white 7th grader.
Can it be explained by economics? I mean, you hear a lot from city governments, it's not our fault, we have to impose cuts, and we're going to hear more from them, I bet, in the next few months on exactly that.
No, I don't think it can be explained that way. I mean, in the short run, that's a good excuse, but the fact of the matter is that this is still a very wealthy country, and you only have to walk into the fancy stores along Fifth Avenue to see that there's plenty of money in the precincts of privilege and elegance. You just see this tremendous opulence, people strolling in and buying watches that cost $14,000, $15,000. This is a rich country. The problem is that the way we finance our public schools guarantees that the schools that serve the poorest kids in America, which are overwhelmingly black and Latino kids, are always going to be shortchanged because the property tax base in these districts is lower than the property tax base in affluent white suburbs. What we ought to do, the only way to deal with this intelligently is to scrap the entire present system of school finance, which depends today either on local property wealth or dribbles of money from the state. We ought to get rid of it completely, and we ought to fund the education of every single child in America out of the real wealth of our nation, which means out of a steeply graduated federal income tax. There's no other way to do it. And also, I might say, there's a logic in this, because kids don't go to public school in America in order to become the citizens of Pasadena, California, or the citizens of, Manchester, New Hampshire. And they don't swear a pledge of allegiance to the flag of North Dakota, the flag of Arizona. They swear a pledge of allegiance to the United States. Yet, in fact, the flag they pledge offers them absolutely no protection when it comes to equal education. A lot of Americans don't realize this, but the U.S. Constitution does not establish education as a protected right for children in this country.
That's Jonathan Kozel. His new book is just out, The Shame of the Nation. I'd love to hear from you. How are the public schools where you live? What do you think of Jonathan's suggestion to make them right? The number is 86. Rising the potential of all kids, regardless of race and class, or are we rather resegregating our schools? Have we resegregated them in a way that isn't the best for the kids and is certainly not the best for us? Our guest is Jonathan Kozel. He's the author most recently of the new book, The Shame of the Nation. It's out now from Crown. In it, he takes on his own liberal friends, some of them. And you talk, Jonathan, very powerfully about large numbers of well-educated, sophisticated people who would probably call themselves liberal who say, well, you know, the solution to our education problem isn't all about money. You can't just sort of pay your way out of this problem, even as they are pouring oodles of money into making sure that the education their particular kids get is the best. Now, continuing from that point, you describe just how differently prepared our kids are, depending on how much money their parents have, when they start school. The poor kids are years behind before they even start.
Well, the most dramatic example of this is seen right in New York City. And, you know, listen, I'm an old liberal. I walked into the radio studio tonight carrying my Nation magazine tote bag.
It's a requirement.
But, yeah, but I have to be blunt with my friends. The fact of the matter is that in New York City, the little kids that I've been writing about for nearly 15 years in the South Bronx, although my new book, The Shame of the Nation, does go straight across the nation and gives the same kind of portrait of Los Angeles and Seattle, but the little kids in the South Bronx I write about now get approximately $11,000 pumped into their public education every year. You lift up any of these children and you plunk them down in the beautiful Long Island suburb of Manhasset, where probably lots of my rich Harvard classmates live. That little girl getting $11,000 now would suddenly be getting $22,000 put into her public education every year. So, you know, we all say in church or synagogue, and even liberals go to synagogue or church, that all our children are of equal value in the eyes of God. And frankly, Laura, in the eyes of God, I'm sure they are, but not in the eyes of America. In the eyes of America, these kids come into their classroom with a price tag printed on their forehead. The little ones I know are cheap babies, and they're treated that way by the United States and by New York. You want to see an expensive baby, you've got to go out to the wealthy suburbs. Now, the reason that, and it's even worse, because before these kids even enter public school, in New York City, for example, the children of wealthy people typically have 2 or 3 years of really wonderful, rich, developmental preschool. All these lovely, classy little Montessori schools, for example. And you can't fool me, Laura, because, you know, I've lived on both sides of the divide. I'm more comfortable with little kids in the inner city, but I still, God help me, get invited to dinner parties by my Harvard classmates. So I know, and they tell me what they do. And they spend typically $22,000 a year to buy their kids spectacular pre-K education when they're only 2.5 years old. While the kids I know, thanks to George Bush, I might add, are overwhelmingly excluded from any kind of preschool education before they get to public school. Then suddenly, because of Mr. Bush, these children are forced to take high-stakes tests in the early grades of school. And on the basis of those tests, some children get weeded out to be in gifted and talented programs, which in New York are overwhelmingly white, as they are in most cities. Some children aren't promoted, and those are the children who are overwhelmingly black. To me, it's just outrageous to give high-stakes tests to children in the early grades of school if we first denied them any chance, any opportunity for pre-K. If there's something deeply hypocritical in a society that holds a little girl 7 years old accountable, and that's the buzzword now, accountable for her performance on a standardized exam, but doesn't hold the president and Congress accountable for robbing her of what they gave their own kids 6 years early.
So she's being held accountable, but no one's counting what's been spent. Let's talk.
I'm counting all the time.
You're counting, and thank heavens for it. Tell us a little bit about the language that's applied to this situation to keep us from screaming as you are from the rooftops about what's really going on. I keep reading about schools that are diverse. You say they're diverse, but there's no white people there.
That's right. The media is, the white-owned media, certainly the mainstream press, including the elite media, the best newspapers, with a few exceptions, simply refuse to call reality by its right name. They'll send a reporter into a school in which there are, you know, 4,000 black and Latino kids, maybe 12 white kids, and 3 other. I never knew who other are. It's such an anonymous. I always think of stripy people or something. And they'll report, this school serves a diverse population. And sometimes they'll say, with many minorities. And this is sheer deception, as though those many minorities were Slovaks and Armenians. They're not. Diverse has come to be a synonym for segregated, and the shame of the nation is that our newspapers will not use plain words to talk about reality in their own backyards. The dramatic exceptions, there are 2 newspapers in the country that are eloquent exceptions. One is the very gutsy St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I just came back from St. Louis. And the other is a marvelous newspaper on Long Island outside New York called Newsday. But with the exception of these papers, almost nobody talks about it. And see, to me, Laura, it's just unspeakable. I don't care how unfashionable it is to talk about this now, and I don't care what price I pay, because the press, including the New York Times, has hit me very hard for coming right out and saying, you know, New York is the epicenter of apartheid. You're running the most segregated schools in America. I don't care what price I have to pay. I'm going to keep on fighting this fight to my dying day, because you know, I don't think those young martyrs of the 1960s struggled and gave their lives so that we could end up ripping apart everything they fought for. And essentially, today we haven't just ripped apart the legacy of Brown. We haven't even lived up to the tarnished promises of Plessy versus Ferguson. As everyone will remember from high school, Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896 decision, it was okay to have segregated schools if they were equal. But we have segregated schools which are blatantly unequal. And it's not just in New York City. Across the board in the United States, an overwhelmingly minority school gets on average, that has 1,000 kids, it gets $1 million less per year than an overwhelmingly white school. Oh. I don't see how Americans can sleep at night.
We've got to take a break, and we're going to come back.
As this goes on.
There's a lot of people that want to talk to you, and we're running out of time. So we'll go to them right after this break. You're listening to Air America Radio. Stay tuned. In Miami, Florida. Hi, Alan. Welcome.
I just wanted to say briefly that it's just thrilled to hear Jonathan Kozol on there. He's a hero for many, many decades, and I'm glad he's still out there doing it. He hits the nail on the head with the educational system, which is not designed to prepare people to become responsible participants in our society, and that's one of the problems. National security should be our public education.
Great. I agree
absolutely
with you.
Right. You want homeland security and educate right. People who live here. Thanks, Alan. Appreciate it. Derek in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Derek.
Hey, Laura, how you doing? Love your show. Just real quick, two quick things, and I'll get off the phone. The first time I called you was on Labor Day, and you kind of took me up to task when I said that you were up against it. What I meant was I knew you were up against the clock because it was near the top of the hour.
Got it.
Okay. Also, my point to Mr. Kozol, does your book address what Black America needs to do in... What is Black America's role in helping to rehabilitate the school system? Because one of the big things that plague our community is lack of involvement. Thank you, and I'll go on and take your answer off the air.
Thank you, Derek. Appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Jonathan.
The answer to that question, absolutely. The book essentially calls for three militant forms of response. Number one, it calls for people of all races and all social classes to support a constitutional amendment that will make education a national entitlement under the U.S. Constitution. It is not now. Most Americans are surprised when they're told that there's nothing in the Constitution that protects children, but that is the case. Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. of Illinois has introduced an amendment to this effect. I support it, and not only Black folks like the gentleman who just called, but people everywhere should back it. Secondly, this book calls for a passionate upheaval of classroom teachers, because they're the best witnesses to this pathological testing mania that's taken over our schools. It calls for a passionate protest movement led by teachers against the mania of high-stakes testing, which now begins now as early as kindergarten in some school districts, you know, where the kids don't even know how to hold a pencil yet, and they pee in their pants out of terror and anxiety. The President Bush is somehow under the delusion that if you make life miserable enough for children by testing them to death, that will compensate for gross inequality in schools. We need a passionate rebellion on the part of teachers. And teachers sometimes say to me, what should I do when I'm told I have to drill them for the tests? And I say, just say no. And I always tell teachers, young teachers especially, don't be afraid that you'll get fired, because everybody interesting I've ever known, they got fired from one job, got a better one. And the final thing I ask for in this book is a massive resurgence of militant protest on the part of all Americans against the return to apartheid schooling in this country. Mm. And that's not going to come from litigation, and unfortunately it won't even come from legislation, and sure as hell is not going to come from the new embodiment of the Rehnquist Court.
So where is it going to come from?
This is only going to come from a broad-based upheaval on the part of millions of young, ethically motivated students in high school, in college, young teachers, and older people who once gave their early years of adulthood to this struggle and have since abandoned it because, you know, they grew out of it and got mortgages or got more interested in social issues that are 4,000 miles away, which is sometimes a great luxury for liberals.
But what's in it for them, Jonathan? I mean, the affirmative action for the rich and the privileged is working for them just fine.
Well, that's right. A lot of former liberals fall into that category. But what I'm saying is, do not believe people who tell you that there is no potential for another protest movement in this nation. I've just been across the nation for the first half of an 80-day book tour, and I can tell you I'm seeing larger audiences than I've seen at any time since 1968. And the young people who are turning out to hear me speak about the shame of the nation, and I don't just mean college kids, I mean
Okay, so we're signing off. Xenophone is in the house, and they're getting ready to come into the studio, both of them, all three of them, all four of them. Again, it was great being back here, you guys. I want to thank Curtis for covering for me for the last 2 months, and you can catch Curtis doing the IMC on Wednesday now. He's doing it from 2 to 4, I think, yeah. And listen to all the Cure Radio shows, they're all great. Again, this is Eric Dolphy in the background, the Eric Dolphy CD, and I'm out of here. This is Cure Radio, 6 p.m. Friday News, and tell a friend, Cure Radio just might save your life. I'm trying to cue up some music to get out of here on, so I can bring in Xenophone on a good note. Oh, and again, if you want to hear the George Clinton interview, go to radioforall.net and type in his name, George Clinton. that's radio4all.net. Kill Radio had a special interview with George Clinton a couple months ago. George Clinton loves Kill Radio.
You fell in love with the Jeep. I can't wait to get home. Hope I see you soon. Knowing night after night up in these hotel rooms, I just sit and think about nothing but you. This is a lot of shade of brown, and gangsters get lonely too.
I know gangsters get lonely.
Slide with me, get high with me, side with me, all night with me. Come ride with a G. It's the Brown Super Bowler. Got ways to make you holler. Everything's top dollar, from the Lex to the juice and parlors. But I need a girl, not just the average. Someone to change up my world, settle down and have kids. Even though my rap on the streets is, I'm a pimp. I need you not to trip while I handle my biz. Let me do what I do while I hustle and grind. Let me dip, stack my chips, and you can have the rest of my time.
No.
Art LeBeau Show.
Hi, Art.
Hey, who's this?
Me.